Turn with me to Genesis chapter 6 and keep open, if you can, those pages, particularly verses 5 to 8. Now, imagine a bedtime picture book story about the volcanic eruption that almost destroyed Pompeii. Imagine a picture book story of the Ibrox disaster of 1971. And yet the story of Noah is one of the most popular stories we tell our kids. It lends itself to the sweeping, dramatic pictures. But it's also sometimes in danger of being sanitized, of being Disneyfied. Because the story of Noah is an intense story of judgment. And it's an intense story of preservation and rescue. It's one of those stories that echo in the memory. Lots of people have a faint idea of the story of Noah and the flood in their minds. But equally, I wouldn't be surprised if nowadays plenty of people really didn't know anything about it at all. We shouldn't presume. So this is a big story. It's a hard story. It's a memorable story. But to understand why the flood happened, and if I'm here again over the coming months and so, we will continue to unpack the story of Noah. But to understand why the flood happened, we need to see the state of the world at the time. Because first of all, this was a wicked world. Now, there was a wife in Scotland who once had to convince her husband to go to church instead of her because she was ill. And when he got back, she asked him, "Oh, how was the sermon?" "Too long," he says. "And what was the sermon about?" "Sin." "And what did he say about sin for such a long time?" "He was against it." There's a danger that I could just state the obvious. That to say that this world is sinful is just kind of goes with the job of preaching from the Bible. It's what churches have been saying all along. But actually, to say that we live in a world where sin and evil touches everything is not always, particularly now in our day, to state the obvious. It's not always to state the obvious. Plenty of people will say, "Oh, you know what? People are, at the end of the day, they're good. People are fundamentally good. They're good people." Now, I get why people say that. I understand the sentiment behind it. But let's look at what our passage is saying here tonight. Verse 5. "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time." Later on in the passage, in verse 11, the part we didn't read, it says, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways." Humanism is increasingly popular in Scotland. And that's clear in the statistics that we have in Scotland for weddings and funerals. Now, humanism celebrates and elevates humanity. It says that there is no God, that there is no fixed morality of right and wrong, and we get to create our own ethics. And if humanity would just use reason and science without God, then the world would improve. Well, use all the reason and science you want, and still the world will feel like it's falling apart. People pull in their own selfish directions, with their own agendas, with hidden corruption, with abuses of power and sex and everything else. Science and reason are fundamental parts of our existence. And they should be rightly celebrated as the order that God has given this universe that he created. But asking science and reason to give us our ethics is like asking a blood pressure monitor to heal a broken heart. It can't be done. The solution isn't us. The problem is us. Every single nation, every single institution, including the church, every single family, every single human heart is touched by sin. How is this the case? Well, back in Genesis 1, God had looked over the earth, over all his creation. He saw that it was very good. But by this stage, in this chapter here, in chapter 6, he is looking out and he sees the opposite. Now that process began with Adam and Eve rejecting God's good rule and refusing to trust God. Back in chapter 3. Now, in between, we see that very rejection of God's rule and rejection of God's goodness and trust. We see it deepen and spread with Cain murdering his brother Abel in chapter 4. But now it spreads further. It's described extensively and intensively. Verse 12 even says, all the people on earth. That's how extensive it is. And intensively, it says in verse 5, every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart. It has spread to the heart. Every apple is rotten. And it's rotten to the core. Ah, but no, surely this is describing the world before the flood. This is just describing Noah's world. Well, at the end of this whole story, in Genesis 8, verse 21, God says, never again, this is well after the flood, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. The heart is the same from childhood, even after the flood. The poison is still there. This isn't just Noah's world being depicted in Genesis chapter 6. This is our world. Everything you've thought, everything you've felt, everything you've done, everything you've said is touched and spoilt by sin to some degree. And it's the same with me. Now, one thing we should all be thankful for is that no one else can read your thoughts. No one else in this room can read my thoughts. You should be thankful for that. I can't read your thoughts, and I'm thankful for that. Honestly, what a relief, because we'd be ashamed and disgusted at each other. But God knows our thoughts. He knows everything you've thought today. He knows everything you thought last night. He knows everything you're thinking right now. He's well aware of what we're like in every part of our being. Now think of a glass of water. Now think of it with a couple of drops of poison. It's not as poisonous as if it was concentrated poison. If this was just a glass of pure poison, that would be different. That's not what the Bible says is us. We're not pure evil, pure poison. We're not fully evil and fully sinful. But you drop a couple of drops of poison in this, then no part of the water is free from poison. You drink a little bit, you put another bit in a cup, it still has poison in it. It's not concentrated full poison, but every part of the water is touched by poison, even with a couple of drops. No part of our faculties is untouched by sin. When people talk about theology and they talk about how every human being, what's called total depravity, that we are totally depraved, totally sinful, it doesn't mean that we are 100% sinful in every way. That's not what that's trying to say. What it means is that we are sinful in every part of our being. There are no compartmentalized parts. There's not nature reserves of water being kept pure and clean. Every single heart and every part of our lives, they aren't fully evil, but they're touched by evil and sin. How is God meant to respond to this? How is God meant to respond to this world and to our world and to me and to you? How is he meant to respond? Well, secondly, we have a judged world. And it says there in verse 6, the Lord regretted that he made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. God is not on Mount Olympus. He's not far away. He's not some abstract philosophical principle. Because when he sees the world spoiled by pain, there is pain in his heart. He sees the injustice and the corruption, and God's heart is filled with pain. God sees the little boy being abused. God sees the girl being trafficked for sex. God sees the beaten and the manipulated wife. God sees the belittled and the frustrated husband. God sees everything. And God's heart is filled with pain. Thousands of years after this story here in Genesis, God stood at the graveside of his friend. And as he stood there, as Jesus, God himself, stood at the grave of his friend Lazarus, as he stood there, he wept. And the passage says that he was deeply troubled, deeply moved in his heart. In John chapter 11. What it means is that he was bitterly angry at the intrusion of death into the world he created. Into a good world. And not long after that story, Jesus went to the cross. And there was not merely pain in the experience of God, but there was death. The pain of verse 6 here, the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth and his heart was deeply troubled. That pain of verse 6 is pointing and leads to the pain of the cross. And so the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. The flood is a tragic story. It is creation being put into reverse. Genesis 1, the waters were pushed back so that dry land could appear, so that men and women and animals could live. Now those waters are returning. Genesis 1, we saw men and women and animals multiply. Now we see them reduced to a handful. Creation was chaos to a cosmos. Now we're going back to the chaos as the flood waters are about to come rushing in. This is a terrible event. But we cannot have a God who cares without a God who judges. Now, I wonder if you grasp that. A God who wept but who does not judge. That's like someone seeing someone being beaten up, but they say, oh, sorry, I'd love to help, but I'm not strong enough. Oh, I feel bad for you. Can't do anything about it. The judgment of verse 7. I will wipe from the face is the necessary consequence of the sorrow of verse 6? Surely not. Surely the necessary consequences of God's tears is that the guilty should be punished and the innocent people rescued. And yes, there are victims in this world. But there's no innocent victims. Not absolutely. It's a hard thing. But in terms of the absolute, it's fine to use the phrase and talk about a legally innocent person. But in terms of the absolute, there's no such thing as an innocent victim. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Russian historian imprisoned for criticizing the Soviet Union. And he was forced to endure the evils of the Gulag labor camp system. He had seen so much evil, and you'd imagine he would be out for the revenge, for the judgment on his enemies. And he said this, "If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and then destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil isn't out there. It cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" Yes, there is good in us. But we are in every part touched by the poison of sin. And to live human life is to have responsibility and dignity before God, which means we bear the consequences of our willfully rejecting God and his good purposes. But the most sobering thing about the flood isn't the flood itself. It's actually what Jesus said about the flood in Matthew chapter 24. And there he says this, "As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man." That means when Jesus comes at the end of the world. "For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man." The flood is a sign of the judgment, the last judgment at the end of time. And it's a warning. This story here, this part of our world history, this flood is a warning for us still, even today, tonight, to get ready. God is being very patient with us. And this flood didn't come for about 120 years after this part of Genesis 6. God was patient with them. Noah would preach and preach and preach, even while he was building the ark. God is being very patient with us. But what we don't like about verse 7 in Genesis 6 is that the verdict of verse 7 is a just verdict. We don't like the fact that God isn't being bad-tempered and moody. We don't like the fact that this is what we deserve. We think it's hard that God would destroy so many people. Actually, it's merciful that he would save any. We might say, "I think it's terrible that God would send anyone to hell." But that's only because we do not understand how broken, how painful, how evil, how sinful this world is. We only think about it in our terms. We don't think of ourselves as that bad. I've not done this, 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 and this. People haven't done this, 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 and to me, it's a good world. Actually, we reject God. If we say it's terrible that God would send any to hell, we actually have to put it the other way around. It's astonishing that God, in his mercy, allows anyone into heaven. And that takes me to my last point here. We had a wicked world, a judged world, but we also have a world with a promise. How can anyone get the mercy to go to heaven, to not be judged like this, whether it's here or at the end of time? How can someone be kept safe from God's judgment? Here is Noah. Verse 8. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, in the Hebrew, the word favor there is literally the word grace. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that Noah deserved God's goodness. It doesn't mean that somehow he wasn't poisoned like all the others. Actually, what happens at the end of the story of Noah after the flood, it's quite clear that Noah was still touched by the poison of sin like all of us. He's like any other human being, imperfect. The next verse, verse 9, one we didn't read, says that Noah was righteous and blameless. He walked faithfully with God. But it doesn't mean that he was perfect and that's why he found grace and favor. Actually, the description of Noah in verse 9 is the result of verse 8. Verse 8 comes first. Him being righteous and blameless and walking faithfully is because God showed him grace. Noah found grace. Undeserved favor. Undeserved grace in the eyes of the Lord. So how does he get it? Well, he followed God. He trusted God. He listened to God. He believed in God. That's what faith is. But how did that get him saved? He wasn't uniquely incredible. Actually, he found grace because of who God is. In fact, we can say instead that grace found Noah. Not that he found grace. God decided in his own freedom as God to choose Noah and to show him grace and favor based on God's own love. God's grace found him and God's grace began to work in him so that a verse later it can be said that he was considered a righteous and blameless man. Why does God show this love? Why does he show this grace? Well, earlier we read chapter 5. This is an account. It's an account of Adam's family line. It's a list of names and all their ages. But the key thing is each generation had children. Each generation kept going. Adam and Eve had a child. And then they had a child. And then they had a child. And so on. And in the Old Testament, every child born, passing on the generational lamp, was another link in the chain of God's promise. And this was the promise first given in Genesis chapter 3. Now, in this passage in Genesis 3, he's actually cursing the serpent. He's cursing Satan for contributing to Adam and Eve sinning. And he says to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He, her offspring, will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." It was a promise that there is a child who will put things right. A child who will be struck on the heel, who will know suffering and pain, who will know the curse of this world upon his shoulders. But in doing so, while being struck on the heel, while suffering, while tasting death, will crush the head of the evil one, will defeat death, and will begin to reverse the curse. Just as the flood is the reversal of creations, as the waters of chaos judge the world, so running right through this story is God's promise of grace and love and salvation. From Genesis, that there is a son, there is a son who will be the reversal of the chaos in our hearts. That's Jesus, dying on the cross. But that death is the very thing that defeats evil and opens the door to us finding God's grace. For God to show us grace. For Noah, that promise in Genesis 3 is the reason Noah finds favor in God's eyes. Because it's based on the promise of God's own love and his plan of mercy and grace. Noah's story is a story of grace in the face of judgment. Even Noah's own name sounds like the Hebrew word for comfort. And it's a loud note of hope in the melody of this story. Yes, this is the world that we're in for now. And yes, God is right to respond with judgment on this world. But God is so merciful and loving that his grace can still find you and me. Noah, and you and me can know God's grace and favor because of the hope and the reality of Jesus taking that judgment on himself. Will you please, if you don't already know the favor and the grace of God, as he takes away the judgment meant for you and me, and he places it on the shoulders of his own son, may you know his grace and favor tonight. May you know how he has always planned to be this loving, even while he is right to judge. There is a way out, and it's through Jesus. It's through him we find grace. Amen.